Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by news editor Graham Davis. How are you doing, Graham?
Hello, John. Very well. And you?
Yeah, not too bad.
Recovered from your house move?
No, not really. it was pretty stressful.
You've come back for a rest, haven't you?
Yeah. That was probably the most stressful week of my life. But, you know, let's not dwell on that. Although there's a lot going on in the news this week that kind of touches upon my house move, bizarrely enough. I'm also joined by Julia Bradshaw, who's going to be talking Kingfisher today.
Hi, John.
Yeah, hello. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad.
Kingfisher is a company that I've spent a lot of money in this week.
B&Q.
Screwfix, actually.
Screwfix,
don't do B&Q.
No.
Screwfix only. I'm a trade kind of guy. Alex Newman, how are you doing, Alex?
Good.
Alex is joining us for the first time. You're going to talk to us about the cover feature this week, which is about the election.
Indeed.
Which is it's a good piece, great piece, well written. Of course, the starting gun was fired now on the election campaign this week. So very exciting stuff, which completely passed me by in the blur of moving boxes around last week. But I'm sure you can enlighten me on what the hell is going on there. So Graham, what's happening in the world at large this week? What's in our 7 days section?
In the 7 days section, talking of election, the boosts to the Conservative Party when UK GDP figures for the final 3 months of 2004 were revised up slightly. So growth last year was 2.8%, the strongest performance over a year since before the financial crisis. So that's good. Well, it was leapt upon by the Tories, obviously,
as
signs that what they're doing is correct, and obviously leapt upon by everybody else as signs that although things are going well, lots of people are getting left behind. So, you know, the usual, the politicians will use it as a ball to kick around. But, you know, things are looking a little bit better. The markets had a bit of a funny week. Everything flipped out a little bit yesterday.
That was Greece again, was it?
Greece.
Which we don't talk about
on the agenda.
On this podcast.
No.
But it's never going to go away.
There was some uncertainty over the Nigerian election, although that's been settled. And, you know, it may have just been the end of quarter, John. People just banking profits. It was the end of the first quarter yesterday. And on our 7 days page, we've looked at some of the performance of the indices over the first quarter, certainly in Asia, where you think there's been a bit of uncertainty over Asian economies, China's slowed down, Japan, nothing that Abe is doing at the moment seems to be working that well in terms of encouraging the economic growth there, but the equity indices have done very well.
Yeah. And I know you've got a piece here about Eurozone deflation fears are starting to ease somewhat as well.
You wonder whether, you know, 1 month into the QE program, is that long enough for this to be really seen in the deflation figures? But apparently deflation eased off in March. So we shall see. Eurozone. German employment figures are very good.
Yeah.
Unemployment in Germany is at its lowest, record low, apparently.
Wow.
So, you know, bits of Europe are going pretty well.
Yeah, nothing feels especially bad to me. And in fact, the world, which seemed horrific 2 weeks ago as I ploughed through the final stages of exchanging contracts on a house move and then packing. It feels wonderful today. I don't think I've ever felt more relaxed.
Funnily enough, talking of Germany, the DAX has risen 23% in the first quarter this year.
Wow.
A lot of that is down to QE, the expectation of QE before the beginning of March as well. FTSE 100 is up 3%, so
yeah,
I know where I'd like to keep my money, I think.
Well, indeed. Let's move quickly on to the news section, because there's some interesting stuff going on there as well. Quindell, one of our old favourites.
Yes, Quindell. It's a very popular stock with investors, this, John. As we know.
It's a bit Marmite, isn't it? It's a love-hate thing, really.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, this week it finally came good on its plans to sell the professional services business for a lot of money. £637 million.
It's basically a law firm, is it, that it's selling here?
Yeah,
right.
Effectively. It's selling it to the Australian company Slater and Gordon. And good news for investors is that it looks like they might get over 100 pence a share back from this deal.
Okay.
What they're left with is debatable. It's a sort of then becomes a sort of technology services to the insurance industry business, much smaller than it previously was. The board has been cleared out. There's a new chief chairman there. Theron Mohammed has kept it on a hold, which has been our sort of default position for a while now.
Yeah, we got a bit of a kicking for that when, you know, things were at their darkest with this company. We got a bit of a kicking for not bailing out completely, not suggesting investors bail out completely. And I think, you know, we kind of been vindicated somewhat.
There was always bits of this business that were decent. Always. And I think that's been proven by what Slater and Gordon are paying for this chunk of it.
I guess the big, I mean, we also saw this week the results of the review that Pricewaterhouse PwC were compiling on Quindell's accounting procedures. And, you know, some of the concerns around what was going on there were kind of borne out with this report. So, I mean, I think they said the accounting policies were at the aggressive end of acceptable practice. Although that technically does mean that they are within acceptable practice.
Largely acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, yeah, they were, yeah, as you say, they were pushing the boundaries a little, but it was all above board still.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so actually our position all along has been, you know, there is some decent, there were some decent, as you said, components within this business. It was an easy one for short sellers to get their teeth into because some of the accounting practices were indeed somewhat dubious, if not illegal. And so now we perhaps have a clean slate here. And yeah, the sale to Slater and Gordon does need shareholder approval. So that's one small stumbling block to overcome.
You imagine it will get that approval, but yeah.
Okay.
We'll see. And elsewhere in the news section, actually, Alex might be able to help us with this because he's written about this at length last week and again this week. Interesting arrival on the main market on Thursday morning, the 2nd of April, expected is BCA Marketplace, which has been bought by Haversham Holdings, which is British car auctions. It owns WeBuyAnyCar.com as well as lots of auction houses, which you may be frequenting soon, John.
Yeah. New car. Well, I've moved to a town that has no direct rail connection, which some may say is extremely foolish. But so I need to buy a second car, which I don't really. There you go. Whatever. So yeah, Alex, tell us about this one. What do we think?
So Haversham Holdings, which was a shell company backed by elements of the investment house Marwin.
Okay, we know Marwin. They've been around. Deals that we've liked in the past.
Got a good record.
Yeah, they've got a very good record, and they together with Autologic's former chief executive have obviously attracted a lot of interest from some serious investors, including Woodford Funds, Aviva, Investec, I think, also in there, to take BCA effectively to the market. So their previous private equity owners tried to list in October, but that fell through, I think, because of uncertainties in pricing at the time.
Well, there were a few wobbles around the IPO market towards the end of last year, and that number of businesses didn't get away at that time and have got away since, Aldermore being one of them. Wizz Air being another, which floated last week, was it?
No, it floated a few weeks ago, but had a trading update.
But the big sticking point to getting BCA to the market was it was saddled with a colossal amount of debt, which is nothing new when you're going from private equity to the main market. But it has cleared quite a substantial chunk of that in this listing. So a lot of that's been paid down, and it's taken out a new facility. And the shares are listing, I think, tomorrow at 150p. Probably will re-rate given that's quite a low multiple, but remain to be seen how strong an investment case it is. Auto Trader is also listing pretty soon, so it is hotting up in the secondary car market.
Yeah, I've been frequenting Auto Trader quite a lot the last few days. I actually wrote editorial a few weeks back on secondary car markets and buying, and Julia, it's one of your sectors, in fact.
It is, we
like it. It's a good sector.
We do like the retail car sector. It's been doing pretty well actually over the past 3 years as new car sales have been growing. Although this year the general expectation is that the growth in the new car market will slow to a more sort of sustainable level than it was maybe sort of pre-crash kind of thing.
But it's been, you know, it's not where it was before the crash, and, you know, it's been rising steadily ever since it bottomed after that.
And the good news is that new car sales trickle down into used car sales, which trickles down into after sales, which is slightly higher margin for the car retailers.
Slightly. Massively higher margin.
It's massively higher margin, but in terms of margins, it's still quite slim.
Yeah, yeah.
It's something to bear in mind. But yes, it is a good sector at the moment.
Is there any of the listed car dealers, the established car dealers that we particularly like at the moment?
We have Lookers on a buy at the moment. We have Virtue Motors on a hold, if I remember correctly. And Inchcape as well, we have on a hold.
Inchcape being much more international in
Inchcape
in scope.
A huge global billion-pound car retailer. That's right.
Car retail. Well, there we go. They'll be getting some of my money, no doubt, in the foreseeable future. As will Kingfisher.
Yes,
Through Screwfix. So let's talk about that, Julia. Well, thank you, Alex, by the way. Sorry, thank you.
Sure.
So let's talk about Kingfisher. Well, what has happened there? Very interesting developments this week.
It is very interesting. So Kingfisher's got this new boss, Véronique Lory, who used to head up their French Castorama business. And she's basically unveiled the new strategy for Kingfisher. Well, actually, quite a lot of things happened. She unveiled the new strategy. They announced that this forthcoming acquisition of Monsieur Bricolage won't be happening because the owners who represent the franchisees in Monsieur Bricolage basically pulled out.
What are they going to do? So they've got some money left over then?
They got some money left over and asked whether or not, you know, they had plans for those earmarked funds. They basically said that they wouldn't keep excess cash on the balance sheet, which basically is management speak for
giving it back.
Yeah, big possibility of shareholder returns.
Okay.
Which is great for shareholders. And we put the stock back on a buy because the rating is pretty low.
Yeah, well, the shares have seemed, when I looked at the share price, because they had results this week, did they not? And the shares have weakened quite substantially.
They've weakened
over the past
a lot.
Year.
Yeah, I mean, last year they had good growth and then they started tailing off a bit. But you know, we think that there's a big possibility that this new strategy for a one Kingfisher, basically streamlining operations across the group, buying power, scale, that kind of thing.
I thought they were doing that already.
No, they weren't really doing that already.
They were doing that already. Well, I used to cover this. They talked about self-sourcing, all that kind of stuff, and it's the same kind of suppliers would be supplying the group. I'm sure. This is fairly standard stuff that I thought they were doing already in some respects.
According to Miss Lory, she went around the business and found that they weren't doing that.
So they said they were and they weren't.
Apparently, Brico Depot in France was completely managed and operated differently than, for instance, Brico Depot in Spain. And whether or not unifying that products across Europe is a good idea, it slightly smacks a sort of EU speak, doesn't it? Where you sort of have one blanket policy for lots of nations, whether or not that'll work.
It does make sense in terms of scale.
It makes sense
power.
In terms of scale, yeah. And we just like the fact that the shares are reasonably cheap. They've got a new story, new chief executive, a big shape up in the company, and then these shareholder returns.
And they're shutting a lot of B&Qs, aren't they?
They're shutting 60 B&Qs.
That's
shops,
a lot of B&Qs.
Which is a lot. But one thing we've been saying all throughout the year is that one of B&Q's biggest weaknesses is that it's got this bloated estate, which it's having trouble slimming down because it's sort of locked into these owners' leases. And now I think they're just biting the bullet and taking a massive charge on that. I think it'll be something around £380 million over the next couple of years.
And they're opening instead more Screwfixes
UK. More Screwfixes, which have been growing hugely, actually. They've been very successful.
Good shops.
They
good
are good.
Shops.
I like Screwfix.
Much better than B&Q. B&Q is where you go if you're a DIY novice who doesn't know what they're doing.
Screwfix is for the pros.
Screwfix is your slightly further upscale.
And the prices are good and the service is good and you don't really wait in line, do you? Kind of like an Argos of
it's
DIY
great.
World.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's another one actually. I think I'm pretty sure, and I might be wrong, so if you're listening to this and I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure the guy that set up Screwfix and sold it to Kingfisher has subsequently set up another trade outlet called Toolstation.
Oh, really?
Which is also really good.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out.
You heard it here first.
Oh, great.
But yes, anyway, so...
So Screwfix is doing well, and doing well in Germany, where they had a trial run, and they're going to open more stores over there, because it's been doing so well. So.
Not surprised. I mean, the trade story is a good one, because we've seen the trade story works for Howden Joinery, which we like, which is a kitchen supplier to the trade. Topps Tiles has started to do a lot more in terms of targeting the trade rather than the retail customer. So yeah, it's good stuff there. Okay, let's move away from DIY and turn to fashion retail, which you've also written about this week, Julia.
I have, and that was Supergroup.
Supergroup, another one of my old favourites.
Supergoop, which has had a pretty rotten year.
Rotten 2 or 3 years, in fact.
Well, just this, it had a good year up until the spring last year, and then it had a pretty rotten year because it had weak like-for-like sales.
But in the past, it's had all sorts of problems with systems and
warehousing systems,
buying the wrong stock, and all sorts of terrible things that
now
a listed business should really get right. But anyway, let's not go there.
Anyway, now we've got it's got a new boss.
Yep.
Which is good. I meet you in Sutherland.
Yeah, and when they announced his appointment, I was somewhat surprised because he was formerly the boss of the co-op.
Yeah, but
not a fashion guy.
No, not a fashion guy.
Okay, but we like him. We like him,
and the reason why if I remember correctly, the reason why he left the co-op was basically because he found the whole structure of the co-op so hugely bureaucratic and hopeless that he couldn't make any changes.
Well, it's a shambles, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And he tried and he couldn't, so he's basically gone to Supergroup, to where he's, you know, hopefully going to help slightly turn the company around.
Yep.
And the big news from Supergroup is that they've unveiled a new strategy, which is pretty much, I mean, they've said it's about broadening the appeal, which basically means going slightly up market, a premium range of products. Idris Elba is the face
Idris
of Supergroup.
Idris Elba. Luther, for those of you
Luther
who are.
Or
and the next Bond.
The next Bond? Is he really going to be the next Bond?
He's been touted as the next Bond.
Oh, okay. Not confirmed then.
Not confirmed.
Well, Mandela as well. He's Mandela, yeah. And yeah, so they're going more upmarket, sort of nicer clothes, more sophisticated clothes, moving away from the sort of Supergroup Japanese logo style garments that they're known for, which is a good move, frankly.
I think it's a good move because I will not wear that stuff as it currently stands. I think it's extremely tacky. Sorry, Supergroup, but you know, I think you're making the right moves here by actually smartening it up a bit.
And we have been asking them sort of periodically, do you think you are going to move away from these logos and this branding? Because it's not really that, you know, you can't really stretch that branding that far. I mean, it only appeals to a certain segment of the population. They kept saying, no, it's our core logo, our core business. But now they've sort of seen the light, which is good. And presumably a lot of that was down to Mr. Sutherland.
Yeah, well, I think it's very sensible. I must have, many years back, just after it floated, probably 2011, I actually put Supergroup on a sell. It was a very successful sell for a while. And on the basis that for a youth brand, you know, when you started seeing dads wearing this stuff, then you think, oh dear, something's going to go wrong here. The core demographic may not take too kindly to these, you know, fat men in tight T-shirts.
Yeah,
I think this is very sensible.
It
very
is,
sensible, because the big question mark over Supergroup was always the longevity of the brand.
Exactly. And I mean, if you go into their stores and look at their products, the quality is good.
Yeah.
They just have to tweak the ranges a little bit. And as part of that announcement as well, they said that they're buying back their US licensee, which is what they've done in Germany and Scandinavia.
Yeah, I remember doing that.
And that's good news, because the licensee there was really not doing what it was supposed to be doing. And they've announced a dividend.
Nice.
As well. So that'll sweeten shareholders, and that was probably responsible for the increase in the share price over the past few days.
So we've got these on a buy.
Yeah, they were a very successful buy tip until about April last year, when the share price started tailing off. But we still have them on a buy.
You've stuck through the tough times.
And the shares are ticking up, and provided that they get, you know, they keep getting their like-for-like sales through, I think there will be some momentum behind the shares to at least bring them past our original buy tip price, hopefully.
Well, never change management, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Could work wonders. God, change management's everywhere. You're writing about supermarkets next
week.
All change there at the top.
It is completely different, yeah. Watch out for that one in next week's IC.
Okay. Thank you, Julia. Alex, let's come back to you. And everyone feel free to chip in. It's politics, and politics is something I'm sure we all have an opinion on. Let's talk about the election. We're not a political magazine. I don't care what the outcome is necessarily. You do you, Julia?
Oh, I do, yeah. I won't speculate on which way I...
Okay, let's not reveal our voting intentions on the podcast. But let's talk about what we are here to talk about, which is what does the election potentially mean for the UK stock market? And Alex, you've done some research here. What's your view?
Yeah, so this is the ultimate change in management, isn't it? Just to continue our previous discussions,
very good.
The outlook, I guess, as you mentioned, John, before, the the starting pistol was fired this week, and today in the Telegraph you've got 100 business leaders railing against the prospects of a Labour government and uniformly damage British business.
That made me chuckle. I heard that on Radio 6 this morning. It was like, yes, 100 leaders have written an open letter, you know, bemoaning the potential of a Labour victory, including the boss of BP and former Dragon Duncan Bannatyne.
yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe Duncan's gyms would benefit from the Tory government. Who knows? Yeah, so we wanted to look at how the run-up to the election is likely to affect shares, and also what the various scenarios will mean for the different sectors which we cover. So the key thing here is that equities probably won't be affected too much by the volatility, because there's in a way a lot to be, a lot has been, it's kind of been forecast by both a sort of commitment from most parties to austerity and a reliance that interest rates are going to stay fairly low. So in a way, a lot of the uncertainty has been priced in.
So Chris Dillow wrote something on this,
he did
this week as well, which I thought was very interesting. I mean, his view was, you might get a bit of volatility in the short term around the election. The outcome might, or we don't know what the outcome's going to be because it's a very tight race. So, you know, the markets don't like uncertainty, as I think you mentioned in your piece. But one thing he says is that, you know, this idea that Labour is anti-business is going to, you know, rip everything up and, you know, it's going to be a nightmare. Chris argues that just simply cannot be the case. You just can't do that because it's the foundation of the economy. And nobody wants the economy to weaken. There may be some tinkering around tax, I think everyone is fairly committed. And you write it in your piece that tax should be fair across the board, and you know the whole avoidance of tax by multinationals, I think, is an interesting point. I don't think any party's against making that a more equitable situation.
Indeed, yeah. But on the multinationals front, it doesn't matter so much what any one politician is going to say. I mean, obviously, George Osborne came out and said he will raise about £3 billion from the Amazons and Googles of this world, which are engaged in transfer pricing by raising a levy there. But ultimately, when it comes to multinationals taxation, that'll be part of a broader effort by the Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development.
Yep.
So politicians, or UK politicians' hands are tied there, relatively speaking. The effect that they're more likely to have is on individual sectors, vis-a-vis different policies.
Okay, so what sectors are we most worried about then? Banking. Surely banking is always a bit of a political hot potato.
Well, indeed. I mean, the Chancellor has already flagged in the budget that there will be an additional levy, which is likely to hit certain banks harder than others.
Yep.
Obviously, you've got RBS and Lloyds divestments continuing and. That's likely to affect those shares, depending on when a sale will come to fruition.
But that's going to be a market thing. That's not so much a political decision, is it? I mean, that's when those businesses are ready to be given back to the public, then they will be given back to the public. I don't think whether you have a Tory government or a Labour government, they can accelerate the process. That's, especially
that's true. And where you may see policy come into force a bit more is regarding challenger banks. I think the Labour's is a bit more keen on seeing a wider market for banking. How it will go about doing that, or whether there is not enough competition already in the banking sector, is another point we've
covered this as well in the magazine this week. In the Sector Focus, we've got a big piece on challenger banks written by Ian Smith. We've actually spoken about it several times in the past. You know, I think it's an interesting point, and I think the point that's made in this piece is that, again, there is only so quickly that these challenger banks can be created. In terms of splitting them out of larger banks, that's a process that takes time. Getting a banking license takes time. Again, it's something that cannot be forced, basically.
Well, the banking crisis is seven years old, you know, and then now there are genuinely some challenger banks now. There are a number of them. It's taken 5-6 years for this to happen.
No, I think so.
Things move slowly in the banking world.
And again, you know, I don't see this as a big, you know, the Tories are hardly standing in the way of the creation of competition in the banking sector. So, I mean, again, a bit of a, I don't know, non-issue, shall we say? I would put it certainly from a political perspective. What about utilities? Gas bills. Nobody likes a big gas bill, and this has been one that's been discussed for a while, because obviously Miliband threw the cat among the pigeons last year when he was talking about energy pricing, and this hasn't gone away.
It hasn't gone away, and he wants to replace Ofgem. He's talked about a price freeze until January 2017, which, given the falling price of commodities, may come back to haunt him.
Yeah.
This probably is the most politically divisive issue in this election when it comes to a specific sector, and it's no surprise to see a few of the names of in energy on that list of 100 business leaders in the Telegraph's letter today.
So we're talking actually the provision of household energy, so your utilities, but also on the list, I mentioned BP earlier, so obviously there's big issues around actually the extraction of oil in the North Sea, for example, I guess. Always a problem. We've discussed the taxation issue with Mark Robinson a couple of weeks back, and quite complicated stuff. The issue you focused on here, which I think is quite interesting, is renewables and potentially the way they're subsidised. This is quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So particularly when it comes to onshore wind farm projects that haven't been given planning permission, the Prime Minister has said he would scrap subsidies there. That's gonna translate to some considerable uncertainty in the renewable space.
Nothing to do with NIMBYism in the Shire, is that at all?
Well, who knows?
Donald Trump wants to build a golf course.
And I suppose, I mean, we didn't mention this in the piece, but one of the running themes so far about looking at the uncertainty of this election is that if it does turn into a hung parliament or several elections, and we do get a bit more pork barrel politics, that these particular issues, the NIMBYism that Graham just referred to, may translate particularly poorly for say a renewable scheme, wind farm scheme.
Okay, so the risks in these sectors is if the election process becomes protracted and drawn out, and presumably the same would then apply to house building, because you know nobody wants 1,000 houses built on their doorstep, but equally everybody wants more houses built, so house prices don't keep rising.
House building is probably the one sector that will do quite well regardless. Every party has committed to greater house building,
and presumably that means some reforms to the planning process to enable this stuff to be built more easily.
Indeed. I mean, the one area where it may come up against it is in London, where if a mansion tax were to be established, which Labour have pushed for, and a couple of other parties are keen on.
Libs, they want as well. They want a mansion tax.
That may affect property builders in London. Yeah, but I mean the other thing it's worth mentioning as well is, which I think is probably one of the very big, you know, the big questions, which is not answered immediately at this election, is the question of the EU and how that translates for equity. So if a Conservative government gets in again, or some form of coalition with UKIP is elected, then that is going to create quite a lot more uncertainty for equities, as the possibility of an exit from Europe is on the table.
That's potentially 2 years.
Yeah. So we're talking 2017 would be referendum, or the referendum would come sooner?
That's when they've committed to hold a referendum by the end of 2000.
I think UKIP would want it sooner, but yeah, they may not get that.
Well, UKIP, but I mean, are they really going to win a substantial number of seats, enough to warrant forming a coalition with? I mean,
well,
they seem to have a lot of momentum, you know, a few months back, and the more I look at it, the wind is leaking from their sails somewhat in recent weeks.
Mm. David Cameron's ruled out a coalition with UKIP, but with all of these deals or non-deals, there could still be some sort of arrangement or voting arrangement.
There'll be a bit of horse trading, like there is in most European countries, as it happens. Hey, yeah. Maybe we could become more European-like by accident.
it's normal in most countries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is why, I mean, one of my views, you know, so there was a lot of concern. I think you've mentioned some figures, actually, in your intro, that after the last election, when we ended up with a coalition government, this would be a disaster and nothing would ever get done. And actually, that's not proven to be the case at all. And, you know, my view would be much the same now. You know, the economy's in good shape, as we talked about earlier. So there might be a bit of uncertainty around the election. But I think I'm not too troubled myself. Not too troubled. But it is useful to pick out some of the sectors where we do need to be somewhat concerned, because you know, a lot of people may have exposure to these sectors.
Yeah.
And it's worth, you can manage that risk, I would say. Okay, thank you, Alex. Thank you very much. Okay. And let's just quickly run through, before we wrap up, what else we've got in the magazine this week. I've already mentioned in the sector focus we have the Challenger Banks written by Ian Smith. Got a big, big accounting piece this week from Philip Ryland on valuing companies on the basis of return on capital. It's really complicated, but this is the kind of stuff that if you are really serious about analysing shares, you need to get your head around. Plenty in the personal finance section, I presume. Graham, we're doing a personal finance podcast this week?
Yes, we are, John.
Yes, we are. So I will not mention that, because that will all be talked about. Then the AIM market is it's still in the middle of results season, so we've got a few pages of results this week. That's going to start to wind down from here on in, and all the usual stuff, all the usual news, data, everything you'd want in an investment magazine. What are you showing me there, Graham?
Five cheap small caps. Talking of the AIM market, LG stock screen this week is focuses on small cap.
AIM. Yeah. Well, AIM had a torrid year last year, didn't it? A torrid year. So, you know, it's due a good one. So, yeah, no, it, in all seriousness, I think it's unfair to say AIM is, you know, full of bad companies. I don't think that's very fair at all. I mean, in a couple of weeks, we'll be doing the AIM 100, and, you know, we look at the very best companies on AIM, and they tend to outperform the AIM market as a whole anyway. So, and Algie's, you know, taking that a little bit further and used his screening techniques to find the best ones still. So, yeah, have a look at that. £4.50 in all good news agents, and I will see you again after Easter. Have a wonderful little break.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.